Everybody hear me okay in the back? Thumbs up from someone in the back? Okay. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming to the, I think it's the last session. I hope it's the last session. I think I'm the only thing between us and the semifinals, right? Going to the stadium. So we'll try to make this fast-paced and exciting and get you out on time here. So welcome again. Thank you. My name is Tim Heuer. I am one of the program managers working on the XAML platform at Microsoft, specifically working for the past couple years on the Windows Runtime XAML platform for Windows 8 and Metro-style application development. And I'm excited to be here and share some things about what's different and what's the same about .NET. And as I was preparing for this presentation, I reflected back on some of the technologies that I have personally worked on, both within Microsoft as well as just like yourselves as a developer in the partner community over the past 15 years, and looking at the different technologies that I had the pleasure and displeasure of some of them of working with. And a common theme came to mind to me about the things that that I worked on most recently. And the highlighted ones are hopefully you can, you know, pull out a theme there. And that theme is that .NET is pervasive on all these UI technologies that have been there for the course of the past good 10 years or so. And so we're here to talk about XAML. So this may not be a cultural reference. This is the most interesting man in the world. But so there's many different choices when you're building Metro-style applications. For Windows 8, you have options of just using native C++, DirectX, JavaScript and HTML, or XAML, and actually two flavors of XAML. We have introduced the ability to write XAML in C++ with WinRT and Windows 8, as well as XAML in C# and VB. I'll be focusing all my code demonstrations on C#. That's just where I'm most productive. Everything that I'm demonstrating can be done in Visual Basic as well. So we're here to talk about Windows 8. I assume since you're here that you know .NET or you wouldn't be here. You know at least some XAML or the core concepts of what XAML is as a markup language for applications. And probably you may be a little concerned. I know that a lot of the, before Windows 8 was announced and there were some things that were discussed about HTML being one of the platforms and not a lot of talk about .NET, and that caused a lot of concern in the .NET community. So you may be here, you may be concerned about, you know, are my skills as a C# developer, VB developer, Silverlight, WPF, are they relevant? Can I do the same things that I have been doing for the past couple years, especially given a lot of the phone platform? You know, are my skills still relevant? So, yes, I'm here to talk to you about hopefully address some of these issues. A lot of the things I'll be talking about do assume that you know some level of .NET and the basic concepts of XAML. So this is not a XAML introduction session by any means. So some of these, if you don't know XAML, they may be a little bit fast-paced for you. So the session description talked about me helping you become rich in the store. If I had that idea, I probably wouldn't be standing here on stage with you, but hopefully we can help you realize that a lot of everything is familiar to you and that you can come up with your unique ideas and get them in the store. So the main theme that I want to get across as I walk through some of the core concepts, and I really just picked a handful of things that I wanted to make sure that you knew that were applied to these kind of two themes here that is both familiar and new, is that as a XAML developer, as a .NET developer, everything that you know should be very familiar, straight down from the Visual Studio IDE experience through all the code and IntelliSense and compiling and all the other tools that you can use as a C# developer. All of that is going to be familiar. And then there's some new things, right? Windows Runtime brings some new concepts, some new APIs, and in the XAML platform, some new UI controls that you can take advantage of. But mostly, I want you to take away from this that as a XAML developer, as a .NET developer, building Metro-style applications should be both familiar and new to you. So here's what we're going to focus on in the duration of this session. We're going to take a look at the developer tools. I know there's been some introductory sessions about Visual Studio 2012. I'm not going to go too much into detail there, but I wanted to pull out some of the things that I felt are important about relative to apps and some of the tooling experiences, as well as some of the app model experiences that that you should be aware of. Uni from the Blend team is giving a session, I believe, on Friday. Is that right? On Friday. About more of the Blend experience as far as working with XAML from a design experience. You will not see any good-looking designs in my session here. It's be a very code-focused approach. So be sure to check out Uni's session as well on Blend for XAML developers. Then we'll talk about the .NET framework, what's changed in the .NET framework, how is it relative to WinRT, and then focus on some of the concepts within the XAML platform or within Windows UI XAML, which is the namespace for XAML in the Windows runtime. And then I'll show a couple of the how development patterns still apply as far as if you prefer the code-behind approach versus the view model approach, and how you can leverage something else new in the .NET framework to basically share view models across some of your target endpoints, whether that be phone, desktop, or metro-style apps. And we'll take a look at some data and resource management, some of the two things that are fairly new here. So let's start off here. Visual Studio, how many people have installed Visual Studio 2012, the release candidate? Wow, good amount. Okay, great. So you should, at this point, at least realize that it's the same great IDE experience that you've been used to over time. Nothing has changed other than the colors, the controversy of colors, right? So not a lot has changed as far as how you interact with the IDE. We do have new project systems with regard to metro-style apps, but everything is should be still familiar to you. This is the same great level of support that you have in the C# and Visual Basic languages for .NET, all the goodness and IntelliSense and the code experiences that you're used to. The plugin architectures outside of Express, so if you're a professional or Pro Plus user, so professional or ultimate, if you use tools like DocuSkater or ReSharper or those type of add-ins or VS commands, those things will still be able to work as those vendors adapt to some of the new APIs in Visual Studio 2012. But all of those would still work within metro-style apps to be able to give you that same .NET experience. Now, one of the new things, and again, Uni will cover this a little bit more in depth, I'll just show it briefly, is that typically as a XAML developer, you usually have probably had two tools open, Visual Studio and Blend. And as you're working in Blend as a great design experience and Visual Studio as a great code-focused experience, you usually have those open at the same time. Now, one of the things that Blend has done in this release is actually kind of created the shared code base between those two editors. So before, where in Visual Studio 2010, and Expression Blend, they were a little different as far as how they handled XAML and how you interacted with them on the design surfaces. Now in this release, as you explore Blend and as you explore Visual Studio, it's a common code base across the designers, so when you're interacting with the design surface in Visual Studio, it's the same experience as if you were interacting with it in Blend. The difference is going to be in the type of features and what you can do in those design surfaces here. Blend is also included in the Express install for metro-style app development. So I've been seeing over the past course of the past few months people wondering, oh, it'd be really nice if Blend was included. It's actually there. There should be a tile for it on your desktop when you install it. So Blend is a part of that install experience and integrated into Express. And then we have some Windows 8 specific tools that we'll walk through in a second. With regard to the .NET framework, .NET is alive and well for metro-style app developments. It's very much a first-class citizen. A lot of the work has been done to make sure that you, as a .NET developer, can interact with the Windows runtime as you would expect in C#. How many people have done this before? Okay, so one of the goals is to reduce this level of interaction with the native subsystems. And so what we do is we do that through these projections of the Windows runtime. Now, you could still p-invoke using DLL import if you need to, and there are some instances where you probably would, especially with regard to third-party libraries like SQLite, as an example, you would still need to do that. But mostly when you're interacting with the Windows subsystems, one of the goals of WinRT was to project these APIs in a way that's familiar to the languages. So JavaScript accesses the Windows.namespaces namespaces in the way that JavaScript would access it. Same with C++. And C-sharp developers, we get what is familiar and what appears to us to look like base class libraries. You can also use C-sharp and VB to create new Windows runtime components. This isn't just a language where we can consume Windows runtime, but you as a developer can create Windows runtime components that if you want to make available to JavaScript developers or native code developers, you can do that as well. One of the things that's probably new to a lot of people, if you haven't done a lot of it, is the concept of async. And I know there's, a session here at TechEd all about async, so I'm not going to dive too deep into that. But if you've never done async development before, that's going to be something that you want to get familiar with. Now, luckily, what the .NET Framework team has done is created a couple keywords for us to make that a lot easier. And these are the async keyword and the await keyword, and I'll demonstrate those and how they can be your friends here. The Metro style apps is, when you create a Metro style app, you'll notice that it's not the full base class libraries. It is the same CLR. However, it's a subset of the base class libraries. And this is a set of reference assemblies that are known to be safe in the Metro model, things that make sense within the security sandbox of Metro applications. So a lot of the system.web type things are not going to be in the Metro profile for you. And so the surface area is a little bit reduced and more specific to Metro-style app developments. And the last bullet point is this concept of portable class libraries, something that the .NET Framework team has introduced in this release. And the goal of portable class libraries is to create a binary-compatible set of reference assemblies that you could create one common code base and target these different endpoints, whether that be the phone, the desktop, Metro-style app development, Xbox, whatever. And you can say, I want to create a DLL that's going to be consumed by all these, and I want to have binary compatibility rather than always using linked source files. And so this is a great concept to do when possible. It's not always going to be possible for you to use portable class libraries, but if you can get it to that way, it is a great way to share code here. And specifically, talking about these code patterns here. So if you're a developer that prefers the what we call the code-behind approach, where you normally have a view and the code matches the view and you have the eventing model that's tied between the two, that's still alive and well. You can still do those same methods. If you're one that prefers more of a separation of concerns approach, uses a MVVM framework like MVVM Lite or Caliburn or something like that, those are also still available to you as well. Let's go ahead and jump around and start demonstrating some of these. So a lot of the demos I'm going to get to are going to be fairly fast-paced. If I'm going too quickly or if you have a question, feel free. These lights are kind of bright, so I can't see terribly well out there, but just shout out and we'll get you sorted out. So here I have Visual Studio Express installed on my desktop here. And we're going to go ahead and just create a new project. Now, I'll walk you through a couple of things that I want to point out. Now, I have a couple other project types that are installed by default or on top of this. But by default, you're going to get a couple XAML projects for you. And again, I mentioned I'm using C#. These are actually all the exact same across Visual Basic and C++ for that matter. So we have a blank application, which is exactly what it sounds like. But we also have these two other applications that application templates that have been designed in partnership with the Windows user experience team to kind of exhibit some of the personalities of what a Windows 8 Metro style app would look like. And so these are more than a blank application. The grid application uses the concepts like grid view and has different controls in it, has several levels of navigation, and the same with split is kind of a master details approach. So these are available to you to pick from, and we'll look at those in a second here. For now, I'm just going to choose a blank application and walk through some of the simple concepts here. So here I have a blank application, and if we look across the right here, we can see that the Solution Explorer is very much, if you're familiar with WPF and Silverlight, this really shouldn't look any different to you. You have an app.xaml, a mainpage.xaml, and each of those are going to have, you know, a code behind file that's associated with them. If we look at this, we can see that we have an X class representation. So again, the same model of the design that we went across in our application model to create that familiarity to you. Now, a couple new things that are here, even in blank. You know, we call it blank, but it's not actually blank, right? So we do have a couple of things that are included in all the templates. And these are required. We chose the bare minimum required so that you could actually compile a Metro-style application and run it. The one thing that I'd like to draw your attention to is this manifest. Now, the manifest is exactly what it sounds like. It's a manifest that describes more metadata about your application and about your the capabilities that you want to declare in your application. So this is where you would pick your name of your application, set some visual preferences. Specifically, we include some default images for as the logo and the splash screen and the store logo, and we set those here. These are all the different settings you can set on some of the visual aspects. But the more important thing is these kind of two tabs right here. Capabilities is a concept of, if my application wants to be able to do something, then I have to basically make it known that it's going to want to do that. If I have an application that wants to use the user's webcam, then I have to declare that in my manifest to say, I'm going to want to use the webcam, so I'm going to make that capability request. Without that, I can still, it's not like Visual Studio is going to hide that API from me. I'll still be able to code against it, but it just won't work unless that capability is set. That's what triggers to the user two things. It's going to alert them in the store, hey, this application you're installing is going to use these set of capabilities. And then when that API is called as well, it will prompt the user in certain circumstances, webcam location being a couple good examples. This application wants to use these services. Are you okay with that? And so giving that user that permission. So this is the manifest is where you would set those properties. Declarations is also an area where you also set kind of behavior type capabilities. So if your application wants to be a part of those contracts that you maybe have heard about in Windows 8 as far as when the user triggers the charms bar and does a search or a share action. These are what we call declarations in the manifest. Now there's two ways you can implement those. You can actually go in here and choose from them and fill out the properties. But we've also made it a lot easier for you as well by you can say, I want to add a new item to my project, and I want to choose the share target contract. I want my application to be a target for share. And so I can add that item, and what that item will do will actually run through a process of adding that declaration in the manifest for you, going into your app.xaml, and applying the appropriate override for that activation event, and then give you some default UI that you can change later there. So take a look at those item templates for the contracts, and I think the four that we do, or the three that we do, is share, search, and file picker are the primary ones that you'll get some initial tooling help out of here. But if we go back and we look at the XAML here, everything that we do here is going to be the same, and you can see that I'm just going to do some very simple XAML here. We have the design surface. And we have the split view here. One of the cool things that we have is this concept of a device window. Let me just bring the design view up. Oops. And we have the device pane here. And what the device pane allows me to do is kind of target some of those new Windows 8 specific visuals. And again, Unisession will probably go into a little bit deeper detail here, but I can say, hey, I want to look what that full screen landscape view looks like versus those different states, right? So my application can be in the snap state when the user puts it in the kind of the first third of the screen. And so I can change that device panel and click here, and the design surface will kind of give me a visual representation of what that will look like. I can also change this to different resolutions and kind of see how my application is going to behave at design time as well. There's also some runtime capabilities we'll look at. But you can see that we have the same design experience here. And as I look at this button here. I have the same blend type experience that we would have as far as template editing. Now, this is where you would probably also leverage Blend. As far as the template editing experience is something that I would recommend using Blend heavily for. What this action would do would be give me kind of the XAML editor experience and explode the template and allow me to edit it here. I personally think Blend has a better overall design experience for you to see those different areas of the template. And so this is an area where you might want to jump into Blend and to implement that. Close some of these tool panes here. And we can go in and we can do our typical code here. And we can just, you know, we have some code that has a button click. You can see that we, you know, I right-clicked and said navigate to event handler. Again, this keeping this concept of familiarity to you. Now, the other thing that we've done in XAML, so I'm not going to run this. Obviously, if I click the button, it's going to say the first name is just going to change to Tim there. Not an exciting demo. So the other thing that we've done is in XAML is really make a lot of the touch-first experiences available to you. And let's go ahead and show a simple one here. I'm going to add a scroll viewer, and I'm going to put an image tag within that scroll viewer here. And what a scroll viewer is exactly what it sounds like. Anything within that content can be scrollable. Now, by me putting an image within it, actually, anything within the content of a scroll viewer can also respond to these gestures automatically, so the pinch and type zoom gestures here. So I have this image tag in this scroll viewer. I'm going to go ahead and change the code here. And we're going to use one of those contracts. Now, we're going to be consuming the contract versus actually creating one. But we're going to use this one called a file open picker. And the file open picker is analogous to the open file dialog, except I can consume data from anyone who has opted in to choose that they want to be a part of that file open picker contract. So I can open items from Facebook, I can open items from Flickr, I can open items from mail or anything like that. And any application that has opted in or declared that capability for this contract will show up in this capability here. Now, you can see the red squigglies that I have in my code here. And one of the things that in the WinRT APIs is that you'll notice that they've done a really good job of naming things exactly of how the action is going to happen. So this API here of pick single file async, it clearly mentions that this is an async method here. Now, if we hover over the red squiggly, we can see that, hey, there's an error here that says the await operator, which I've added here, can only be used within an async method. Now, if I didn't know that I had an async method and I just called it like this, which this is perfectly fine here, but also now if I hover over this, you can see that I get some hinting that says, hey, this method is awaitable, and it gives me this little usage snippet here. Which I would go in and add this. And now I just need to add the keyword async to the method call itself. And by doing this, now rather than having to create my own async event handler and callback mechanism, I can program in C# how I'm used to in something that feels like it's inline code but is actually doing async development here. So by marking the method async, and then I will be able to call using the await method or the await keyword on specific methods that make it available. And again, the IntelliSense within Visual Studio lets you know if methods are awaitable here. So let's add some more code here. And what we're doing here is showing that we're actually doing an async call right here on line 46. We're making an async call to this file picker where we're going to pick the file. But you can see that as the code reads, it kind of reads very cleanly to me as a developer that I'm just kind of reading how I normally would, that it feels like I'm doing synchronous programming. But by using this await keyword in the async and the compiler tricks that it does, it allows me now that I'm not going to be able to use this file object until it returns from that async operation. And the compiler does all that trick for me here. So now what I'm doing here is once I got that file, I'm going to, you can see again, I'm using the await keyword. I'm going to open that file, and I'm going to create a bitmap image and set that to the image within the scroll viewer there. Now, in XAML, a couple of things that we've done is we've added some performance improvements as well. This is one of them in the image area, where let's say you're opening a file that is, you know, 8 gigapixel or whatever, but you're only going to show a 100 by 100 thumbnail. Rather than just kind of setting the image to that stream of massive megabytes and having us decode all of those bytes of the image, even though you're only going to show it in a small portion, we'd prefer you to use these two new APIs on bitmap image that you tell us what we need to decode to, and so we won't waste a lot of performance doing things that are unnecessary. So I know that I'm going to display the image in 200 by 200, so regardless of the image that I'm going to pick, I want to set that value. So let's go ahead and run this here. So we'll click this here. We will click a picture of me. And so now I have this image within a scroll viewer. Now, I don't have a touch laptop on my machine, so this is pretty worthless to show. I just have an image within a scroll viewer here. And so one of the things that Visual Studio has done is allowed us to simulate a lot of these behaviors. So I'm going to launch this application again within the simulator. And now I can go and simulate touch behaviors. So if you don't have a touch machine, because either you can't afford it or, you know, the other guy on your team has it, you can still use this simulator here to simulate touch gestures. So we have basic touch gestures, but we also have these are basic touch, but we also have touch gestures. So I can grab the pinch zoom, and you can see that I kind of have these two adorners. And so if I have a mouse wheel, I can left click and scroll to kind of get that behavior. And so I'm getting this gesture support because this is in a scroll viewer, and I automatically get that pinch zoom and other gesture support. And I would get rotate as well if I developed for that. So using the simulator as something that can really help you out is something that is very helpful for you. Okay, so now my mouse. Of course. So now what I'm going to do is let's talk about some development patterns I mentioned here. So I'm going to open up Visual Studio Ultimate. I mentioned the portable library project. So we're going to first create a portable class library here, and we'll just use the default name. Now the reason why I'm using Ultimate is because the portable class library project is not available in the Express SKU. It's in the professional and above SKUs. And you notice when I say I want to create a portable class library, the first thing it asks me is, what target frameworks do I want this to target? And these selections that I'm making here are going to dictate the reference assemblies that are going to be available to me as the developer. So I can say, hey, I want .NET 4.5. These are the defaults here. I want Silverlight 4, Windows Phone 7, et cetera. The second I start making different choices here, so if I want .NET 4, but Silverlight 5, you know, it's going to give me some information saying, hey, everything that you've chosen is going to apply, so we're going to add certain things on there, or it will tell me that I can't choose those combinations. So I'm just going to accept the defaults for now. And we're going to change this. We're going to create a view model. So we're going to call this the person view model. And we're going to add in our view model, we need to implement iNotify property changed. So this is the same thing that you would do in WPF or Silverlight to kind of create this separation of concerns here. So I've just created this view model, which is kind of the intermediary layer that allows my UI to talk to my data through this middle layer here. And I have an application that I want to target in Silverlight as well as a Metro-style app, but I don't want to write code twice. I want to create the same view model once, but just different UI representations on top of that. So I'm in my portable class library. I've created my view model here. And we're going to add a couple other things here. We're going to add a delegate command, which is just an implementation of the iCommand interface. And then we'll go in here and implement that. And really what we have, so we've got this view model that basically has a person's name and has an event, a command. And this event is the save person command. And just for demonstration purposes, I'm just doing a debug write line to the output here. Obviously, this would be something that, you know, you're saving back to a database here. And so now what I'm going to do is build this, make sure it compiles. And I'm going to add to this solution here, I'm going to add a Metro style application. And we'll go into, first set this as our startup now. And so in this Metro style application, we're going to add a couple things here. The first thing we're going to do is actually add a reference to the portable class library. Now, I'm doing a project-to-project reference, but you should recognize that by doing so, I'm actually doing a binary reference, right? I'm not doing a linked source file. I could have very well just browsed for this DLL, but a project-to-project reference is a binary reference. It's not copying files across by any means here. And then, so now that we have that reference here, let's go ahead and add some resources. Now, here is one of the things that I wanted to point out that is slightly different than Silverlight and WPF. Now, if you're familiar with XAML, when you use different user controls or third-party libraries or this concept of what we're doing here with just a view model approach, and in ordinarily you would, well, you're always going to create this XML namespace where you kind of give it this this namespace that maps to your actual namespace here. Now, in Silverlight and WPF, you see this CLR-namespace, and it has a full fully qualified assembly path. In WinRT, we don't support the CLR namespace nomenclature here. We are adapting this just simpler approach of using, and just you specify the namespace. So you can't specify which assembly this this resides in. This kind of falls in line with a lot of the other WinRT guidelines that an actual assembly name matches the namespace that it applies to. But you'll notice that this is one of the differences between Silverlight and WinRT XAML is this concept of using versus CLR namespace. So once we have that, now we have basically our resource, our view model as a resource here, and we've just given it this key VM. And so let's go ahead and just add some content here. So I'm going to add this stack panel, which just has a text button, a text box, and a button, and it has this command. And you can see that the command I'm binding to this view model and the save person command off of that view model. So if we go back to our view model here, is that we're basically binding this to this command right here, which the implementation is just the debug write line. And so I've written no code in my view. Remember, this is my Metro style app, and I'm just creating the view here. So if I run this, and I click the button that's save, in theory this would go back to my database, but we'll just look at the output here, and we'll see that we were able to see the output that the command was hit, and everything works fine for us. So that sounds all well and nice. Now let's see like how this really applies here. So now I want to have my Silverlight application, and I want to make use of that same view model. So I'm going to go in my Silverlight application. Let's make that the startup project now. And we're going to add a reference as well to the portable class library. Again, this is a binary reference, so I'm not linking source code. I'm not doing any if-defs in this regard here. And we'll go into the main page of this. And we actually can just copy a lot of the code over, except instead of pages, we're using user control here. And we will have to add the XML namespace. And you can see that here it has the CLR namespace with the fully qualified there. And we'll go ahead and just copy this stack panel as well. And now we're going to go ahead and run the Silverlight application. So again, I'm creating a different view based on the same view model. I've written no code in my views other than just the markup and the data binding. And click save here. If I go back, oops, too far, and look at the output there in my Silverlight application now, I've used one common view model at a binary compatible layer across a Silverlight application and a Metro style application. So this is one way as .NET developers that we can get reuse out of our codes and target multiple platforms and be able to, again, kind of target the different endpoints. So most commonly, this is probably, I see this as someone having a phone application and a Metro style application as kind of companion applications and being able to use those same view models at a binary level. Now, this isn't, again, this isn't required. I'm just showing that this is a way that you can get your separation of concerns and using the view model approach and achieve binary compatibility without having to link source files or do a lot of if-def approaches or conditional compiles. Now, it's not going to always work for everybody, but it can work for most. So now let's talk about, I mentioned also, like, as a .NET developer, you know, how can I create WinRT components? I want to be a part of creating WinRT components for other people to consume. So let's go ahead and create this class library here. And I'm going to go ahead and compile this. Actually, I want to point out, so we've chosen the C# Windows Metro style category, class library, Metro style apps. So we've chosen that, and we've created this class library. And I'm going to go ahead and build this. So how many people think I just created a WinRT component? Trick question, right? So this is probably one of the bigger misconceptions that we have, is that this class library for Metro style apps is a WinRT component. That's not true until we do a couple more things. There's a lot of projects out there that are referring to themselves as WinRT toolkits, et cetera. Unless you are actually compiling and targeting the Windows runtime as your output type, you are just creating a traditional .NET class library that can only be consumed from .NET. So as far as we're concerned right here, this class library 6 is only a .NET class library. The key in making it a Windows runtime component, as far as .NET goes, is changing the output type to a WinMD file. Now, I think in the final release, we will actually clarify this and call it a Windows runtime component. So you can change this, or you could have started out with the project template Windows runtime component, which is basically a class library with that property already set for you. And by doing that, we can see we'll change that, and we'll rebuild, and we'll see that now we're getting some errors because we need to start conforming to the Windows runtime rules and guidelines here. And so some of those are public classes, if I can spell. So we'll just create a method here. And notice that I'm just using, you know, the .NET and C# that is familiar to me. And I'm going to build that. And so now I have now I've produced a Windows runtime library using C#. So now we can consume this. Now we could also, if I was writing a class library where the only consumer was going to be .NET, you know, you should think hard about whether you need to actually create a Windows runtime component. Most of the time, if you're living only in the .NET world, you're probably not going to have that requirement. If I want to create a component that I want to share and make available to C++ developers or JavaScript developers, then yes, I would need to do that. Now, the caveat is that those components that you would create from a .NET developer's perspective would have to be non-UI components. So I can't create a XAML custom control that a JavaScript developer can use. We don't interrupt UI layers that regard. Now, if it's XAML to XAML, you can do that, where I can create a custom control that has XAML that is a WinRT component that a .NET developer can consume and a C++ developer can consume because we do have that interop layer there. So I can go in and create a JavaScript application here. And in my JavaScript application, add a reference to that Windows runtime component, class library 6. And just add some script, which you can see that this looks, you know, familiar to JavaScript developers in their, you know, in the JavaScript language, but to us, it's just going to look exactly how we would in .NET as creating a new instance of that. I would actually be able to get IntelliSense on this as well. If I look at this and say WinRT, you can see that it's projected as the JavaScript language syntax of a lowercase, a camel case type syntax here. But now as a .NET developer, I can leverage my skills and be able to create a Windows runtime component that's consumed by JavaScript. So I could say Tim, and it just outputs, hi, Tim. So this JavaScript application reached out to the CLR, executed my method, and returned the value back. So this is a simple thing. You could think of other things that, you know, maybe wanted to do some processing of, you know, something that faster number processing or something like that, or image manipulation. But you can use your .NET skills to be able to do that and create that Windows runtime component there. Okay. So let's look at just kind of set up the XAML here. So Windows UI XAML is the namespace that is where all of the XAML UI framework sits for Windows 8. You should think of anything that was previously like in system.windows is probably now in Windows UI XAML. That's not a 100% case, and the main reason being is that there are things that were common to the Windows runtime overall layer that were moved into, you know, higher up than the Windows UI XAML namespace. Some things like color is a good example, or more of the primitives are going to be higher up in the namespace. But again, from a control standpoint, from, you know, a UI that you're going to build, you could think of the analogy of system Windows is now Windows UI XAML. So these are the same XAML primitives. So you think of buttons and text blocks and text boxes. All of these controls have been optimized for you for touch experiences. So in all the default control templates, we've done the work to understand the hit targets for buttons and for any of the list panning and interactions. I demonstrated the scroll viewer as an example that automatically responds to the gestures. In addition to the primitives that you know, we also have some new ones that exhibit some of the more Metro-style app development kind of personalities. These are things like the grid view and list view, so that start screen experience that you see where you have groups of these kind of tiled experiences. That's kind of what we in the XAML world call a grid view. Or a list view, which is kind of a next iteration of the list box experience, where it has the correct touch modes for list selection and swipe gestures. We also have the semantic zoom control, which, again, if you're familiar with the start screen experience, where I have a lot of data and I can zoom out into more condensed groups and kind of zoom in and zoom out of these views. And then some of the more commanding experiences where we've moved some commands into this. One of the primary concepts of Metro-style design is this content over Chrome. So where do you put your kind of traditional menu commands? And we call that an app bar. And so that's a new XAML control that's available to you as well. In addition to the UI controls, we've also done the work to expose the animations for those personalities for you as a developer as well. Now, if you use all of the out-of-the-box controls in probably the more use cases of, you know, how you're going to use them, and maybe you'll just style them differently, but functionally you're going to use them exactly the same, you shouldn't have to worry a lot about the animations, because, as an example, list view and grid view have all the built-in animations for you of when the elements kind of animate in and when elements are added and removed from the visual trees of those particular controls. The proper animation of them being added and removed are all built in for you. If you, however, you're building your own controls and you still want to take advantage of those animations, we expose those animations for you. So the animations that Windows, the OS, uses and that all the other UI frameworks use as well, so the ones that HTML uses, are exposed, available to you under the Windows UI XAML namespace as well. So we expose these as two things: either theme animations or theme transitions. So theme animations are things that you would add to a storyboard, and you control the storyboard of when it starts and stops. And a transition is something that you can declaratively apply to a UI element. So I can say, hey, I have this stack panel. I want to apply a transition of the add remove or add delete transition. So anytime things get added and removed to the stack panel, that will trigger the Windows OS add delete theme transition animation that's appropriate. Now, another big thing that we like in the XAML world is the ability to extend our platform. There's a lot of ISVs here that are in the Tech Expo, actually, that have built a lot of UI controls on XAML as well. And so that extensible platform still exists for you today, and so we still have a good third-party ecosystem. There's some subtle changes there, and let's go ahead and walk through a couple of these here. Okay, so I mentioned first that these kind of default templates, and let's take a look at the grid application to talk about some of these new controls that exist. So I'm going to choose the default grid application template, and I'm just going to run it locally here. So what you're seeing here is this is a grid view control, and this is actually what we call a grouped grid view control, where we have these different groups that are separated and they have the contents within them. And so there are certain controls that we also virtualize the data. This is one of them. So you can have your data virtualized. So you can see that, you know, if I'm only showing a certain amount on the screen, we're not going to draw everything on the screen unless it's required. And so within this grid view, we have these individual elements here. I'm going to click an element. Now, again, I don't have a touch laptop, so I'm just tapping things or clicking things rather than tapping things, but the tapping and the panning gesture automatically work versus me having to drag the scroll bar. Now, within here, we have a navigation model, so similar to what Silverlight's navigation model. However, it's not URI-based. It's more type-based, so you navigate to a type instance of something rather than a URI of a specific page. But we're demonstrating using the navigation framework here. And I have these particular elements here. Now, if I had a touch monitor here, what I could do is actually pan. So I'm in group title 1, item 1. And I could have swiped with my finger, and I would be at item 2. But you notice that when I scroll over, because I'm in mouse, I get this adorner here. Now, this, what you're seeing here, is one of the new controls as well. It's called a flip view. And a flip view is basically an items control that does exactly what it sounds like. You can flip through the different views and the items here. And so this is a good example of how we've designed the touch interaction built into this. So when you use a flip view, the user in a touch experience can swipe back and forth and go from next to previous. When we recognize that the mouse experience is being used, we draw these next and previous adorners on the flip view for you, which actually are just parts of the control, so you could style them how you would like as well. And so this flip view will just navigate back and forth through these elements here. Now, I mentioned custom controls. So I'm a control vendor, and I'm going to create, I'm going to start out with a class library here. Did anybody create custom controls? Maybe you didn't even know it, but you were. Okay. There's to draw a distinction between what I call a custom control versus a user control. A user control is something that's generally within your project, within a single application. User controls cannot be styled or templated, and they're usually representative of a composite controls, right? So I create a XAML page that is a composite of maybe some text blocks or some images and things, and then I can use that chunk in another page. A custom control takes that same concept a little bit further with the idea that I'm going to distribute this across multiple projects, right? So a custom control defines a specific template. It can be styled, it can be themed, and it can be distributed. So some of our partners that are here, like Telerik and Infragistics and DevExpress, they create custom controls for us as developers to consume. And how we do that is the same model exists that from Silverlight to WinRT, but there's some slight nuances in how you distribute them. As far as a developer experience goes, it actually is the same experience. So I'm going to create a lot of item templates to help you through this. So we start with a class library, and I'm going to create add an item called the templated control. I'll just keep the default names custom control. And you can see that we've added this themes generic XAML. So if you've never done custom control development before, this is where you define your definition of your UI for that control. Not all custom controls have UI. We assume when people are doing this that they will. So we add that default one in there for you. Now what we're going to do here is, and you can see that in our custom control one, we say, hey, you're going to get your style from this style key called, or that applies to custom control one, which we can see here, the style key applies there. So the other thing that we've done is we've tried to make it, again, this concept of familiarity. So I just used the PropDP snippet in Visual Studio, which is the same snippet that's been used in WPF and Silverlight. We've actually just revised it to make it more specific to Metro and I guess easier overall for everyone to use. Only one property has changed, but overall the concept is the same here. So I'm going to create a dependency property. A dependency property is a property that can participate in binding and can, it's usually the default type of property that you create when you're doing custom controls if you want people to be able to set it through binding. So I'm going to create a dependency property called default color. And I'm just still using this snippet here. And there's that last property metadata. And in mine, I'm not using that at all, so I'm just going to set that to null. So what I'm doing is I'm exposing this property called default color to my control, so someone that can be able to use it in binding or in code setting it as well. So I'm going to make that a part of my default control template as well. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to set up just an initial color. And we'll say Bisque sounds good. I was going to pick Azure. This is the only Azure I would show in the presentation. But so we'll set this initial color here. And now in our control template, we're going to set the property of default color. You can see that I get that IntelliSense experience. The Blend team has done the work to reflect upon what are the dependency properties I'm doing in my custom control. So I'm going to say, hey, that default color, the value you're going to get from this static resource called initial color. And then I'm going to go into my control, and instead of background binding to background, I'm going to say you're going to get your property from default color. So again, from a developer experience, this is the same that you would do in Silverlight or the phone. And now I'm going to add a new project to consume this. So I've just created this custom control, and set this as the startup. And now I want to use that control. So I'm going to add a binary reference. Again, I'm just using project to project here. And so I'm going to add a reference to class library 7, which is where our custom control lives. I'm going to go in my main page here. And the same thing applies how we were doing user controls before, or with the view model. We have to give this a namespace. So we'll just call it controls. And we'll see IntelliSense gives us class library 7, so we're able to use that using concept. So let's just create a stack panel here. And we'll say controls, custom control, width is 200, height is 200. And let's create a second one, same size. But we'll use our custom property here. You can see that now I have default color. And because I said it's a solid color brush, again, the Blend team and IntelliSense has done the work to say, hey, I know what kind of dependency property this is. I know what type it is. I'm going to create a good developer experience for you. And so we'll just choose blue here. So again, I didn't promise any wondrous UI here, but I should show and blanched almond doesn't show up very well on the screen, apparently. But here's our custom control, which is basically just this default border here, and I'm able to consume that. Now, if you recall, in our custom control, I had this specific solid color brush here that was called, that had a key value of initial color. Now, let's say for some reason in my app, I wanted to use that brush in other places as well. So I'm reading the documentation that was provided to me by my ISV. that says, hey, we've got this control, but we've also got these other resources you can use. And I say, wow, this initial color sounds good. I'm going to change this so we can see it better. And I want to use that in my application in other places. So I'm going to go in my application here, and I'm going to add an ellipse. And I'm going to say, I want the fill to be this initial color. And so, in theory, right, this should work. So I want to say, hey, I'm aware of this static resource called that has a key called initial color. I want to use that. Now, again, our helpful friends in Blend here is telling us, you know, giving us some blue squigglies. So if you're familiar with all the different colors of squigglies, blue means you're going to compile, but you may run into issues. Now, the reason why we don't one of the reasons why we don't validate static resources kind of as a strongly typed mechanism is because those can be loaded at other times as well, right? So right now, Blend is saying, I don't know what this static resource is, but I'm just giving you a heads up because, you know, maybe in the runtime your app is actually loading a brush from somewhere that has this name, and I'll resolve it at runtime. But at design time, it's saying, I can't resolve this. And in fact, at runtime, it won't be able to as well. If we run this, we should get a pretty nasty runtime error. And in fact, we do. We get an unhandled exception. If we look at it, you know, system exception, the best kind, right? So we know that something's wrong here. And that's because we haven't told our application where to get this resource from. Now, how many people have done WPF development? Not specifically. Okay. Are you familiar with the pack URI syntax? Right? That's awesome syntax, right? In Silverlight, we call it the component syntax. We've got an easier one, or hopefully an easier one. And so what I'm going to do is I need to tell my app where to get this resource from. So I'm going to just create a merged resource dictionary here. And now, if we take a step back here and think about where we're getting this from. This is this resource that I want to use exists in my class library's themes generic file. Now, the pack URI syntax or the Silverlight component syntax was basically this verbose syntax that told you, hey, you're going to get this resource from this assembly that's located here in this path. So one of the things that we've done in WinRT, and actually this is part of the resource model of WinRT, is used this packaging syntax. So ms-appx refers to your package. And so anything starting with ms-appx is your application's package, starting at the root of the package. Now, a triple slash basically is telling us to start at the root of the package and find these resources. Now, we know that ours is in this class library 7 in a folder called themes generic XAML. And so let's save that. Now notice Blend was smart enough to realize, like, hey, I think I can resolve that now. And if we run our application, we get the ability to use that. So this concept of using this new, for lack of a better term, this new pack URI syntax is slightly different than what you've experienced in Silverlight and WPF before. Now, you may be asking yourself, well, how does it know where to get things from? Well, let's take a look at the deployed application of App 1. So remember what we have here. We have a custom control that we've gotten from a vendor. We've added a reference to it, and now we're consuming it. How does that look when we go into our package here? So in the developer experience, when you just F5 an application, it does actually create a package. It does what we call a loose file registration. And so instead of creating an appx and deploying it, it just puts it in in an appx folder and emulates what the exploded package would look like. So this is our exploded package here. Now, notice these two things right here. We've got class library 7 and class library 7. So this is our apps package. This is app 1. This is the thing that we're uploading to the store. Now, one of the bigger differences that we have from a .NET developer's perspective with regard to resources, more specifically to custom controls, is we no longer embed the XAML into your assembly. And you can actually see the other parts here, right? So main page and AppXAML are just a part of the package. They're not a part of the executable. They're not a part of the DLL. The same with the class library. So I have class library 7.dll, but I also have this folder in here. And so what's in the folder? If I look in the folder, I have exactly whatever has been marked as content in my class library. So it's no longer embedded in the DLL. It's a loose file asset within the reference component. So now this is how, when we use the MSAppX syntax here, I'm telling it, hey, you're going to find things in this location here. And it just happens to literally translate to a folder within the package of where it gets those elements from. So this is something to keep in mind when if you're developing components for others to use, or if you're also developing components within your organization as shared components. Now, the third thing that you would do to distribute these is different as well. Now, because we don't have embedded content within your DLL, I can no longer just email you this DLL and for you to be successful. If I just sent you this class library 7 DLL and you added a reference to it, your actual coding experience should be fine. But when you ran it, it would say, I don't even know where to get the control template. You told me to find this default style key. I'm looking in places where it should be, and it's not there. So we have this new mechanism, and I'm not going to walk through this here. It's a little bit more verbose. I'll show you an example of one of this concept called extension SDKs. And extension SDKs is where you would basically package the content of your SDK in a specific way, and this is another area where you define a manifest and you tell it where to get certain files. So here's an example of a manifest where I say, hey, I've got this this file, this DLL is part of it, but also I have this file or this folder called redist. And this is instructions in my extension SDK to say, so I have common configuration, neutral. If I had architecture-specific things like x86 or ARM or x64, they would be in different folders here. But I would say, here's the other things that you need to ship as a part of this SDK. So Visual Studio, and using this mechanism, when I add a reference to an extension SDK, it looks at this redist folder and says, anything in here, I need to copy to the package, as is. Now, there's other ways you can give a little bit more instruction to how it's being copied, but for the most part, I think everyone will just use the defaults of copying it wholesale here. And so it will take whatever's in that redist folder in the appropriate configuration and copy it to the package under that folder name. So it says, I know I'm class library 7. I know I've got this redist content. I'm going to merge those together and make those a part of the package. So if you're a control vendor, this is something that you'll want to understand on how to redistribute your controls. Now, some people may be saying, well, I really like the embedded resource model. Why can't I have that? You can if you want. The things you will lose is probably some design time capabilities, and you're going to be responsible for your own resource extraction. Now, the reason why we made this change is because, again, we're not just a .NET platform. We're actually a native platform in WinRT, and the same model has to apply to our other languages. So we didn't want to invent two embedded resource models in C++ and C#. So we coalesced on one model. And right now it's this loose file asset. So the same model, everything that we just walked through in C++, they're not getting any special benefits. They have to do the same thing as well, and we have this same model. So if you chose to embed your own resources, you would also be responsible for pulling them out. And from a developer experience, you'll probably have a little bit degraded of an experience from a design time experience. But you can certainly do that. It's just going to be a little bit more work for you as the developer. Okay. Any questions so far? No? Okay. Where's my clicker? Okay, let's talk a little bit about data. So data you can't have an application without data, right? Data comes in many shapes and forms. As .NET developers, we've gotten used to being able to, say, add service reference. If you think about Metro-style apps, most of your data is going to be coming from a service-based architecture. So as .NET developers, we've gotten used to these proxy code-generated class libraries for us. Those still work, and they still work exactly how you would expect them to work. In addition, we have OData support as well in .NET as you've had it in other .NET capabilities. Now, in the release preview for OData support, it's actually only available in the Ultimate version. However, in the final release of Visual Studio, it's not going to be available in any Visual Studio version. It's going to be a separate add-on that you can get from NuGet or the Visual Studio Gallery. So you will be able to use it in Express or any other thing, any other SKU. But for now, if you're looking to do OData within the release preview timeframe, you'll need Ultimate to get all the services together. This is a session from TechEd North America, the Dev 336, that you can learn about all the OData goodness. Now, other things that we've gotten out of the ability in Metro-style apps is something that a lot of people have been asking for in Silverlight, is dynamic and anonymous type binding. So you're able to do those type of things easily now in Metro-style apps. This is very helpful usually when you get data that is going to be structured in a way that you're not storing that structure or you don't want to do any serialization. A very common example is I'm getting a JSON stream of data, and I don't have a type representation of that data, but yet I can parse the JSON stream and just do a link query and say select new into this type, this new anonymous type, and bind that to a list box. So anonymous type binding is very helpful, just kind of for one-way type binding where you're just displaying data, but you can do that. Local storage is also possible in Metro-style apps. We have, in .NET, you're usually using isolated storage. In Metro-style app development, that's going to translate to the Windows.storage namespace. This is file folder-based local storage that resides for your application, right? So it's kind of sandboxed to your application, not shareable in other places. There's two other structured type storage that you can use that will be supported for Metro-style apps. In the Windows platform itself, we have the EZ engine, or also referred to as the JET APIs. Those are available to you. There is no managed wrapper currently that allow you to access those, so there are some open source wrappers that you could use. EZ is more of like an ISAM-based database mechanism, so there's not a query processor on top of it. Our friends at SQLite, the open source project at SQLite, have worked with us and made available that SQLite will work on Metro-style app development. In fact, their latest release that they just put out a couple weeks ago supports Metro-style app development and will get you through the store certification. And in addition, there's open source libraries that work for you as a .NET developer if you've been using SQLite in other platforms to be able to query on top of that. So let's take a look at some of these data concepts. Okay, I'm going to create a new project here. And just to show you some of the good things that we've done here, I'm going to add a service reference. So add service reference still exists. And the first thing I'm going to do is add a service reference to a SOAP service. So this is the Microsoft Translator service. And you can see that it found the internet's working. So it found the service, and we'll go ahead and add the service reference. So the thing that the Visual Studio team has done is recognized I've got this SOAP client, and I'm in a Metro-style app, so I'm targeting .NET 4.5. So I can do, I should follow the same principles that that .NET would want me to follow. So if I create the translator client, and look at the APIs, you can notice that they're all async, right? So the proxy that's generated for you is not the same SOAP client proxy that if I was in a WinForms 3.5 application. This is an async proxy layer that uses a task-based approach, so I can use the async and await keywords on this proxy that's generated for me. So this is done for free for you if you're using the SOAP-based proxies, as well as if I'm using OData feed like Netflix, I can still be able to get the Netflix catalog, and you can see that it would generate similar proxies for me. Now, OData is a little different because the way you query it is through data service queries. So the data service queries are async rather than the literal OData object model. But you can see that same mechanism, again, that familiarity of me using at service reference, getting strongly typed proxies, and being able to code against those still exists for me as a developer here. Now let's go ahead and remove this. And show some data binding here. So here I've got basically a stack panel that has a list view with a data template that just shows some text blocks in here. And so when I click this button, I want to basically go out and fetch some data and bind it to that list. And so here we'll also see the some of the transitions, the default theme animations that we have in list view of when items are added in. So I've got this, when the button is clicked, I'm going to create this list of person. This is just my person class here, first name, last name. I'm adding a couple people to it, and I'm just saying the item source for that list view is this list of T here. And so let's go ahead and run this. And so we should be able to see first name and last name here when we click get people. So first you saw that animation kind of slide in. Again, that's the default personality of list view of when items come in. Those are there. Now what we see here is three items. We expected three items. We had it. That was part of our list. But we only see the last name. So something's wrong in our application here. So if we go and we look at the output in our application, we can see that we've got some errors here. And what we've done is we've added this new event to WinRT that basically alerts you to that a binding has failed. Now, the default templates will basically emit this to the output window as long as you're in a debug conditional compile. So we're not alerting you to anything. We're not debug breaking or anything. But you could certainly go in and add your own event handler to the binding failed event and be able to inspect this. But we can quickly go in here and say, oh, I've got binding expression errors. And it tells me I can't find this frist name property. So I can go back in and correct my spelling. And say, yep, I misspelled first, and run the application here, and correct my binding error and get the results there. So we don't have one thing that we couldn't get to was the Silverlight 5 kind of data binding breakpoint debugging in XAML, but this is something that we felt is helpful for managed code developers to be able to surface these binding errors in an event. And again, by default, if you're using the Visual Studio templates, these will be output to the output window for you. If you're C++ developers, there will always be output there. But for managed developers, we added this specific event too. Okay, I got a few more minutes here. Let me do another quick example here. And this is talking about localization here. So if I wanted to localize my content, I'm just going to add some resources here. Now, I'm going to add a resource file, so similar to a resx, and in fact, the underlying schema actually is a resx if we were to look at this in XML. And if you've ever worked with ResX before, this editor should look very familiar to you because it's the same editor. The primary difference between .NET developers is that we no longer generate strongly typed resource class definitions for you. Again, this goes back to the overall WinRT design of that we're following an overall Windows resource model that applies to JavaScript, C++, and C#. And so we don't have this strongly typed representation of these files. What we do have is, so what we've done in XAML is we've kind of leveraged this merge concept, for lack of a better term. So on this button, I can say, hey, I have this UID, I'm giving it this UID of hello button. So I'm going to go in here and I'm going to say hello button is the thing I want to localize, and the property I want to localize is content. This is a button, so the property is content. And so I just want to give it the value of hi. And let's go ahead in our German, add a resource file as well. Hello button, content, hello. And so you notice that we're using this folder-based approach. So I'm basically saying, hey, I've got content for ENUS and content for DEDE, and I'm putting that in here. However, when I use a path-based approach, so I'm referencing this image with the source of th.jpg, but notice how I'm not saying ENUS-JPEG. These folders will translate basically kind of to a lookup dictionary in WinRT for you, and it will recognize, oh, I'm English, so I need to look in the English folder for that resource. It will automatically find the correct path for you. So if we run this application, we should see a picture of me and a button that says hi. Now, how do we test German? So how have you tested it in the past? Is you probably had to install a language pack, change your regional settings, reboot the machine, or have a second machine. One of the things that Windows has done in this is create this concept of language list preferences. So now I'm on an English Windows install, but I can say my preference is actually German. So now when any application runs, it will honor my preference list as a priority over whatever my OS is installed. So again, I have an English OS, but my language list preference has said I prefer German. So when I run this, we should get our German content. Now notice that the button, we can't see Hallo wie geht's because it's not big enough. So we can easily go back in and the localizer can say, hey, wow, we need to change that. And so in the German version, they can say hello button width needs to be a little bit bigger to show the content. We run the application and we see the full button there. So using this XUID approach for resources allows us to kind of do this merging capability, and for lack of time, I won't show you the guts of that, but essentially what happens behind the scenes is those resources, both path-based, actually all paths, even your main page.xaml, because that's a path, right, and your load component, it's loading the URI to that file. All path-based resources and anything in a res.w file will get compiled into this concept called a PRI, a package resource index. And a PRI is a binary representation of your resources. There's SDK tools for you to dump that to an XML so you can kind of see how it shows the path to your resources and how it looks at qualifiers. A qualifier is the language name, the BCP tag. Or a qualifier can be high contrast. I can say, hey, for that image, I actually want to supply a high contrast image or a different scale image for the different plateau patterns here. So here's what we just kind of walked through for the resources. You can use folder-based convention or file-based. I could have named that file th.lang-dedede and gotten the same approach. I think we would all prefer the folder base. It helps you organize things a little bit better. The big difference here is just calling out again, there's no strongly typed class generation for resources. It is something that we're looking at. We're actually looking at it to possibly prototype as an add-in. We have heard feedback about it, but we think this model is what we've done in XAML is a helpful model that you don't always need those strongly typed resources here. So just to close up, you can absolutely use .NET for Metro-style apps and more. We saw building WinRT components, building custom controls. I didn't show building a custom control consumable from C++, but again, as long as I created that as a WinRT component, I could have added that templated control item, done a couple changes, and created a shared component that's used across all the XAML concepts there. So your skills as a XAML and .NET developer are absolutely still valid, and you'll be successful in getting apps to the store very much. So I'd like to end on my friend Sean Garrity said this quote once. The technology you use impresses no one. The experience you create with it is everything. So if you could take that away when you think about being successful in the store is, create great experiences. The people using your application aren't going to know whether it's XAML or not. Just focus on creating the great experiences. So thanks again for sticking around. I appreciate it. And be sure to fill out evals as well. Appreciate an eval to let us know how we've done here at the session. So thanks a lot.